Greetings, ladies and gentlemen. Now listen, you're listening to the Casterbras podcast with a K. Don't worry about other podcasts. Let them gawp, let them gape. Yes, did you know that we're available on Casterbras.com, iTunes, Stitcher.com and Audioboo? Well, you do now. Good, isn't it?
Because this week you just have James and I. Lucky you, right?
Well, so it seems. He may or may not appear.
He may. Well, so then he is the mummy of this week's podcast. He will only appear for 66 seconds at a time.
And then we'll cut him off.
And we will cut him off.
I like that. I like that. That will ruin his riff. That's good. I like the segue there you did. That's pretty impressive.
Hey, thanks.
Yeah, pleasure.
So, by the way, guess what we're talking about today?
I don't know. I've lost my train of thought on this.
I think...
Orientate me.
Oh, I don't think we need to go.
I might have an opinion I could express, but I'm not sure.
Well, keep going. I'm like...
Nah, are you sure? I think I'm murdering this joke.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, you've guessed it. We are talking about Mummy on the Orient Express. That episode that we all watched last Saturday, in case you still don't know what I'm talking about.
Yes. And right? If you don't, then really you should just switch off this podcast and perhaps listen to a podcast more suited to your level and quality of character. Maybe a Midsummer's Murders sort of podcast, you know.
That's it. Yeah. Oh, well, you know, missed opportunities.
Missed opportunity, yeah. Christian will do that. Yeah.
You know, honestly, before we get into the Midsummer-ness and any other things about the story, there's one main thing I want to just quickly get your opinion on, because you and I spoke about this last podcast.
Yeah.
I'm curious how it played out for you.
Okay.
And that is the aftermath of the Clara... Doctor clash at the end of Kill the Moon. How did it pan out for you this time?
It did exactly what I said it would do, didn't it? It just, you know, there was no real reference. I mean, okay, you could say it was an answer to the question made last week, but there was no real. it was very disjointed again, wasn't it? The way it just brought it in. Uh-huh. On an assumption that we didn't know about. We'd obviously not had the conversation where they had another conversation where they said this would be their last one. There was no response. There was no room for the Doctor to make any response or reference the things that she had accused him of, particularly. That being said, the episode did a very good job of handling it, if you see what I mean.
It felt
as disjointed as I thought it would be, yet at the same time, I liked the way they handled it.
Yeah, exactly. I was kind of glad, in a sense, to not like get so heavy-handed with it, because and here's the main reason I was glad. Okay, I know some people will say, well, that doesn't make sense with what you guys said last week. The main reason I'm glad they didn't get so heavy-handed with it is because we didn't have to spend massive amounts of time in Clara's flat while they're talking about, hey, come on, just one more adventure. Let's do this.
Yes.
Don't be so angry at me. Come on, why don't we? You know. Instead, we just got right into it. I will say, for like a moment or two, I thought, are they going to go down like some creepy territory? Is this going to be like a hologram Clara? Is this going to be one of those splinter Claras? Like he just went and picked up himself another Clara, because they weren't discussing it at first. And then when they got the first like hint of it, then I was like, okay, all right. So one last hurrah, you know, but there's two things about it. One, like I said, I was glad that we didn't have to sit there and watch like a second fallout as they try and discuss whether or not we should do this.
Yeah.
And two, I also felt it was a bit strange because if Clara was that pissed off at him and, you know, that kind of, you know, get out of my life kind of thing, why would she go, oh, hey, you know what, just one more adventure, just for good old time's sake. You know, it felt so, it did kind of feel a little jarring not having the middle conversation, but at the same time, I was glad we just got right into the story.
I think in a sense, I think it bugged me a little, not because I think what they did, I think they did well. I think it was the right move. And I think, to be fair, you can sort of say the epilogue to the last episode with Danny sort of led to this by him sort of pointing out that she's not done with him yet because she's still angry. So yeah. You could say there's your bridge. But ultimately, I somehow kind of was a little disappointed because I felt that it was such a big moment they'd built up to with her breaking from him. It was such a big thing that, you know, they'd hinted on it in The Caretaker. They played it out in Kill the Moon. And then you felt like, in a sense, it was resolved so quickly that it was almost like a build up that was almost something that never happened. Because the next episode, which we saw, because I thought this was going to be a Clara Light episode where you'd have the Doctor on his own, then they would do the makeup or the resolution. It did feel almost like it was missing a chunk in the middle. That said, I did feel that I didn't mind the way they did it. Okay, so
yeah,
we must halt the podcast there. Because I believe it is, let me get my glasses. I think only I can see him at the moment. I don't think Brian can, but I think some aging northern corpse of a mummy has just entered the room. He may be our editor and boss. I'm not sure. Can you see him yet, Brian?
I don't see this. What James, are you okay? I'm concerned. I'm very concerned right now.
Yeah, I'm a little disappointed because I have a feeling my death is imminent in 66 seconds, and I kind of hope that my death would come through some sort of orgasmic moment of pleasure rather than at the grubby coal mitts of a northern coal miner turned journalist. Oh my God, how many people have I offended in that? I think probably I do deserve to be knocked off.
You've just offended
couple.
The entire Northeast.
I think I have, haven't I? Well done.
Hello.
Hello there.
Hello.
Sorry, incidentally, I come from the Northwest, technically. So, in a sense, you know, we have a divide that we can sort of spar on like this. He says, excusing his inherent.
He thinks.
Yeah. We'll see when I get brutalized next time I head up to York or somewhere like that. Welcome to Christian, our editor, who has made it after a very busy day. We weren't sure whether he'd be here today, so we apologize for breaking up the flow. But there you go. We've broken up the flow. But it was for good cause, wasn't it?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Christian, we were just chatting quite amiably before you interrupted us with your cadaverous being about the rather jaunty shift from the end of last episode, the Kill the Moon, and the being the end of their relationship to this one where we suddenly come in sort of almost in media re, in the middle of things with Clara and the Doctor having made a sort of decision to have a final go.
Mm-hmm.
And we wondered we didn't wonder because you weren't here, so we weren't really thinking about you, but we'll pretend to be polite that we were. We wondered what you thought about this. Did you find it jarring? Did you enjoy it? Did you feel that they needed a middle section? Were you expecting a middle section where there would be no Clara? There would be, or, you know, they'd be on their own?
Yeah, I was expecting a Clara-free episode. To be honest with you, I thought we might top and tail with Clara, Mrs.
You got your mini mummies with you as well.
Yeah, for a time being. Yeah, the mini mummies are here. There'll be silence on the podcast from them shortly.
The mini mummies.
Yes, mini mummies. They. I thought it was going to be a Clara free episode. I was very surprised to see it. I do like the Bob though.
It
was a nice surprise. It was a nice surprise.
Did they keep her out of the trailer? Because I don't remember seeing her in the trailer.
Did. No, they did. I'm pretty sure.
That's interesting. That's interesting. Interesting indeed. So, I mean, we jumped in there because Brian had this urge to sort of talk about this. He had to get it off his chest. But since at the moment I seem to be sitting in Christian's seat, which makes a change, which is actually fairly comfortable.
It's quite dusty. There's a bit of coal on it.
Yeah, it reminds me a bit of my seat, with, you know, obviously minus the coal and a little less arrogance, maybe. But
I doubt that.
Yeah, Christian and Brian, how did you feel about the episodes? But Christian, you're late, so you can be first.
Oh, thanks. I think it's the best episode of Series 8.
Really good.
Yes, I do. I was absolutely gripped from start to finish. You know, there's things in there that, you know, it even ended with that much maligned sort of misunderstood alien kind of trope, didn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that it was just like a soldier that was trying to bring his long, terrible life to an end in some way. But everything that builds up to that was absolutely fantastic, and it was gripping. It was tense. There was the base under siege element to it as well. Mm-hmm. The claustrophobia of the train. It had a nice turnaround with the holographic elements, and you know the change in the change in the set design and everything. Peter Capaldi was absolutely fantastic, and I had a feeling from the trailer that he was going to be rather fantastic in this, and I have a feeling that the presence of Clara enhanced it even further. I have absolutely nothing to complain about with this episode. I don't think that there's any faults to it at all.
Okay, here's one potential fault, and I'm saying this as a devil's advocate. Do you feel that, given the build-up for the mummy, that the resolution with the mummy was slightly lost, that the ending was a little jarring, or do you think that was artistically intentional, that it sort of very much...
Are we talking the explosion here?
Well, we're talking about pretty much from, you know, the resolution of the mummy to the explosion as well. So that whole sort of end final act felt very different to the previous two acts. Was that a problem, or do you think that
I felt slightly surprised at the time, but upon the subsequent dialogue, it gave the impression that there was something that we weren't being told in a good way.
Right.
So hopefully that means we're going to find out something else happened later on. Now, I say that, and then you go and have a look at what's going on with the final four episodes, and you find, well, final four episodes. Well, where is this going to happen exactly? So I don't know. It didn't really annoy me too much at first. I know there's a missing scene as well. Did you see the Ask Me Anything from Jamie Matheson?
No.
It was on Reddit on Saturday night after the episode. And he said that there was a scene cut on the beach with Maisie that was just cut for time, basically, before Clara wakes up. And I think it was a very good scene on the beach on the whole. And I feel that there is something more to it. And I hope we find out what it is this season. And it's not one of Moffat's. You'll find out next year, or you'll find out in 3 years' time with the TARDIS blowing up. But I don't consider that to be a fault of the episode. I've got absolutely no complaints with that. I do honestly think it's the best episode of this series. And, you know, I enjoyed Listen immensely. Mm. And I enjoyed Into the Dalek a lot. I even enjoyed last week's too, to an extent. I think it was more the fantastical end of Doctor Who. I definitely don't think it's as bad as Doctor Who's worst. It's certainly not a nadir of Doctor Who, the Kill the Moon. But this week's for me is up there with, you know, Blink and Human Nature and Seeds of Doom and Inferno, and, you know, has been an example of the very best of Doctor Who. I think it was brilliant.
Brilliant. So as Christian closes his spreck hole, Brian, your mouth should open. What was
all
your
I
feelings?
Want to say is that was more than 66 seconds, Christian.
I'm well dead.
Yes.
Damn it. I really enjoyed it. We were saying about the whole resolution to that. Well, not resolution necessarily, but the whole skipping over the middle part of the argument between Clara and the doctor. I liked it because we didn't have to see that stuff, and I didn't like it because it felt a little jarring. But it didn't really detract from the rest of the episode, because the rest of the episode was very solid. I do agree. I felt it was very classic series. While I know I was saying before that I kind of get a little tired of the whole just incidental creatures, you know, kind of things going on, this one really worked. It had a good selling point for it. It seemed a clever idea for it, or at least a clever twist as to why this thing was doing what it was doing, you know, just a soldier thinking he's still in a war. I am a little bummed that it seems like there is something still to learn from this episode, because mainly the way Moff works, it usually is weak as a payoff, or we don't get it for a very long time, as Christian pointed out. But forgetting that aspect of it, I really enjoyed the fact that it was a train in space. I liked the fact that they enjoyed the rail system that was in use in space. Originally, I thought, like, oh, you know, we've already seen a period piece recreation of a spaceship, you know, with people in period type clothing as well. And I thought, man, do I really want to see that again?
Titanic. And you're talking Voyage of the Damned, though.
Yes.
Voyage of the Damned, yeah, sorry. Yeah. I should have mentioned. But yeah, I mean, and it was like, it's already been done. We saw the future version of a past thing. But I liked it. I didn't mind it. I thought I was going to mind it, but I didn't mind it at all. The story, probably because the story itself just works so well. Peter Capaldi was on top form. I love the fact, somebody told me recently, I love that the jelly babies being in that scene was his idea. Yes. And if that's the case, I think that's brilliant. But yeah, I liked everything. I mean, I even thought Clara was good in it. I think maybe down at the end, I got a little hesitant again when you know, she's now lying to Danny and the doctor, just to kind of have you know, the cake and eat it too, as they say. But on the whole, my qualms with the episode are very minor. It was really just an enjoyable one. I really think, unlike last week's, I'll watch this one over and over again.
Yeah.
Do either of you two think that there was either a couple of red herrings or something, as you say, yet to be resolved, but there was a couple of looks that was made by, and I can't remember her name, the blonde girl, and there was a look
Maisie.
From, I can't remember his name, Frank Skinner. There was a couple of reaction shots near
Perkins.
The end, Perkins, that almost suggested it as if you were meant to think that they were something to do with the resolution of the plot, or I don't know, did either of you two spot that? There was just a couple of looks that they gave. And if you didn't see it...
Not so much with Maisie, but I don't know whether it's maybe just because Frank Skinner is a comedian and quite limited as an actor. He did kind of lapse into a kind of narrowing of the eyes when things weren't quite as they should be, which... his delivery of the lines was absolutely fine. It was just his facial actions weren't great. I'm hoping it's just because of that and not because they're... I mean, you know, there's a big question about Gus, isn't there?
Yes.
And who or what Gus is. And, you know, we've had links to, you know, there's been people saying on forums, you know, the Twitters and other places suggesting that there's some link between Series 8 and Series 4. You know, we've got Kill the Moon, and then we've got an episode that's got the word forest in the title, which links us back to the Science and Library story. And, you know, that's something that people have been talking about. You know, but as I say, we've only got four episodes left. And if someone's going to go around, sort of like asking the doctor, inviting the doctor to come on board a vessel and start helping them, and then putting a force field around the TARDIS to stop people leaving the vessel, you think of one person, don't you? Automatically, maybe two, but mostly one person.
Are you down the Master Rani track?
Yeah,
again?
Yeah.
Which are you down, the Master or the Rani, or both?
Either or both,
right?
Yeah. So, and you know, that would be a bit obvious, but again, it's someone who knows the Doctor, and you know, and then we've got the identity of that person, haven't we? Who gave Clara the Doctor's number back in that shop back in 2011,
yeah,
11, 12, yeah.
Yes. Thank you, Mini Mummy. There, that was a very insightful opinion.
You know,
I mean, the other thing with Gus, with the Gus and the Perkins thing that got me was, is that obviously they said that all the irrelevant characters on the train were holograms, and the whole thing was set up for a purpose. That's why I was starting to think, is Perkins going to be the person behind Gus? Because he was the only one that wasn't a scientist, technically. Well, he had intelligence, but... So, again, I didn't know whether that was a red herring or not. What I'm going to do, I'm going to try and give... Because I haven't given my opinion, I'm going to try and give it in the 66 seconds.
All right, I thought you were going to give it in the artistic method of dance for a moment, then.
I can do that as well.
Interpretive dance.
At the same time. Well, I'll have to speak as I do it. So, what did I think? I thought it was brilliant. I think, like Christian, I agreed. I thought it was an excellent episode. I think it was possibly one of the best of the series. I think Clara was very well handled through the episode. I felt that her issues while I was worried they were going to become whiny and annoying, I felt were slightly slightly passive. They weren't pushed. The ending resolution I liked. I quite liked the naughtiness with Danny Pink. I thought it was kind of cool because while it's good to see Clara having her pedestrian life, you know, the Doctor is something special, and I like that. The show made me feel that you could see that she saw something. That she had a relationship with the Doctor, which was a bigger thing than just, you know, the standard conventional love. That there was something really, there was a deep connection there, as there was with Danny. And I kind of felt of late, we've lost that feeling that there was a deep connection with her. I thought the effects were brilliant. I thought the mummy was excellent. I thought the resolution worked. It was a character story as much as a villain story. And we got bits of both. It dovetailed nicely. And I agree, Capaldi was fantastic. It was a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant story. And now I'm dead. There we go.
Okay. There's a couple of things I wanted to say. You know, we were talking about period settings in space.
Yeah.
Now, The Coming of the Terrifiers by Michael Moorcock, which came out, I think, in 2011, which is a Doctor Who novel, one of the big Doctor Who novels that the BBC Books run with the special authors.
Yeah.
That had a scenario of period dressing in space as well. So we've got that as well as the Voyage of the Damned. And, of course, Voyage of the Damned is essentially... What was the ship called?
Titanic, wasn't it?
Exactly. So it's essentially a riff on Douglas Adams' Starship Titanic game,
yes.
Isn't it?
Yes, there is that as well.
You've
got Enlightenment, haven't you, in the previous series, which, yeah. Again, was actually at the time, that was pretty spectacular because you didn't really do that. I mean, people knock the 80s, but the 80s was when you were starting to get this sort of very smart mixture of creative exploration dovetailed with smart use of production values. So you could go and take from the wardrobe department stuff that was contemporary or historical and use them in sci-fi settings rather than just silver suits.
Yeah.
And you started to see that Happiness Patrol is another example where you, and Greatest Show in the Galaxy and other examples of where pedestrian or contemporary or historical clothes were being used in futuristic environments. And it's very good from a production point of view. I think it's a very smart move. And I agree with you, Christian, and I think Brian as well. I think it was a very solid standalone episode. Again, and I agree with both of you as well, I think it'll be a shame if it is pulled out into something further when, in a sense, again, it's another episode which just works on its own.
Yeah.
It'll be a shame if they sort of try and lengthen it. But yeah, I liked it. I really thought Clara worked in it. I was pleased because I've not liked Clara of late, and I liked her again in this one.
Yeah.
I thought that was good.
Now, did you two, before I arrived, did you do the Midsummer Murders thing?
Well, we sort of slightly mentioned it, but we didn't really touch upon it because you weren't here.
Okay, that's fine. That's fine. So
we missed you.
Yeah, you missed. Well, that's nice to be missed. So did you talk about the links between this episode and Midsummer Murders? Or
we haven't.
Superficial.
No, we haven't.
Okay.
No.
So, dear listener, there's some links between this episode and Midsummer Murders, namely four of the principal cast. And you've got Peter Capaldi. He's played the Doctor, as you know. He was in an episode of Midsummer Murders a few years ago as a distraught vicar whose wife had left him and was having it off with the murder victim, or a murder victim. John Sessions, who was the voice of Gus, who was in an episode of Midsummer Murders which involved some painters, and he was a randy painter who was having it off with various women. There is David Bamber, who is probably best known to TV viewers as a familiar face in Charles Dickens adaptations and the lead character in Stephen Moffat's Chalk from about 10, 15 years ago. He was the captain of the train. And there is Christopher Villiers, who's probably best known for his work on Emmerdale, that popular ITV evening soap opera. He's also in Top Secret. You guys seen Top Secret?
I don't think
no.
so. Oh, wait, is that that movie?
The comedy movie.
Oh, yeah.
From the airplane guys.
Yeah, I think I have.
Yeah, he's the British agent in Top Secret.
Good to know.
Yes, and of course he was in King's Demons. And he was in the very first Midsummer Murders. And of course, we do mention Midsummer Murders quite often on the podcast.
Despite I've never seen it.
Have you never seen it?
Never seen it. Never, never.
Well, Peter Davison's done a Midsummer Murders. He's done a Peter Davison was in a Midsummer Murders. And Mark Gatiss as well was in one that was repeated, as many of them are on ITV3, a couple of weeks ago, where he gets lanced with a great big Norman sword. And he plays in a vicar who's lost his faith.
Right.
Yeah, it's a good one, that one. So, yeah, it's quite some links with Midsommar Murders there, which I was very amused by. And they all gave great performances in Midsommar Murders, and they all gave very good performances, convincing performances in the Mummy on the Orient Express. There's nothing wrong with this episode, I don't think. Even Frank Skinner, who, as I mentioned before, isn't an actor. You know, he's mainly a stand-up comic and a radio presenter these days.
On it's worth pointing out, he has done acting before.
He has done acting before, no, absolutely, yeah. But he isn't known as an actor, is he? He's not a regular...
Yeah, he's personality.
...actor. Yeah. And, yeah, although, you know, there's... Go on, Brian.
I was going to say, I will say one thing with him. I didn't mind him. I thought he was fine. I thought it was a fun role. But did it feel like, to anybody else, essentially, did it feel like the scene of him in the TARDIS was merely written because they knew he was a fan? And it didn't really need to be there story-wise.
Well, I think if they'd not lost the missing scene, it would have probably felt more balanced, because we didn't see what happened to Blondie, did we?
No.
Because they took the scene out.
I think they probably left it in for that reason, rather than wrote it for that reason. Because I imagine it would have been written before he'd...
Yeah, so if you'd had her departure on the beach and his in the TARDIS, given they were the principal survivors, it'd have probably felt less odd. As I think what you feel, Brian, that it felt a bit sort of superfluous almost. But if you'd had that as well, I think seeing the two of them off would have felt less weird, because it did feel weird. Because everyone else was just went disappeared. It was just him. He's like, well, what, why him? What's about everyone else?
But how good was that Mummy?
It was brilliant.
Wasn't it just fantastic?
I also wanted to say the soundtrack. I thought there was some very nice... movement to shift to the sort of old retro little elements to the music, which don't know
well,
if
I haven't rewatched yet.
Well, rewatch it and listen to that.
I will do, because I always know when the music's good, because it means I haven't noticed the music.
Yeah, no, that's one of the key points of incidental, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
But there's some nice touches there that just gave it a little extra yum, I think. But yeah, I love Capaldi. I thought he was brilliant. And everyone I've spoken to on this one, I mean, we got slammed in the comment section last week again for being so negative, which I found...
I got shafted midweek. Don't worry about that.
I found it just stunned me, given that I think we've all been pretty positive, apart from, you know, obviously we find criticisms here and there.
Well, I, to be honest with you, I think we were quite positive with Kill the Moon.
Yes, I think... Well, this is what annoys me. And there was another comment, and... Bless the gentleman, I don't mean to pick on him, but it was sort of like, well, you know, this is what Who fans do. And it's like, no, it's what you should be doing with anything that you're called to assess. You should be able to critically assess it. And sort of fawning over something constantly is pointless. You know, you're there to sort of offer constructive opinions of what works and what didn't. And I think we do. But this episode is quite hard to be particularly critical with.
There's a guy called, well, I don't know what his name is. In real life, but he claims his name is Andrew Kamholtz, and he emails me to tell me that he's going to stop reading the website and that he's stopping listening to the podcast and all this kind of thing. And I get it baffles me why anyone would take the time to email me and tell me that.
Well, yeah, that's it. You know, if you don't like something, don't. And especially, we had this, and this would probably be quite a good segue for Christian in a section as he sort of takes over the mantle of this podcast, with the Neil Gaiman and Stephen Moffat article that we've got up at the moment. And there were some amusing comments there, and the same sort of thing is, if you don't like the article, why are you reading it? You know, you don't have to pay for this magazine. You know, because Sturbridge doesn't cost you anything to be sort of suggest that, you know, how we run things, or how specifically Christian edits there, runs the site, is somehow some up for debate. You know, you're not a shareholder. You don't pay for it. If you don't like it, don't read the article. Criticize the article if you want. That's fine. But criticize the use of the article. Well, you know, none of your business, really, to a certain degree. So, yeah, it's incredible that, you know, people can be so good. But I think we've been pretty positive on these sort of things. I think Kill the Moon was genuinely a terrible episode. It was a mess.
Again,
I
think you're pretty positive about that.
I don't think it's a terrible episode. It's not Time in the Rani. or, you know, it's not as, and as we are going to discuss Trial of a Time Lord once series 8 finishes.
Yeah, I think
it's not The Mysterious Planet. You know, it's a far better episode than either of those. So I think terrible is the wrong word to use.
Well, no,
it's a surprising episode that takes some things that you maybe, it takes some turns in the plot that you wouldn't expect it to take, and not in a good way. It starts off strong, it ends poor, and it probably...
But does it? I agree with you. I mean, terrible is a very sort of backseat journalism comment, because you'll find good in everything. And I think last week when we talked about this, we all found things which we could sort of highlight in it. That, you know, the production values were excellent. The acting was excellent. The cast was spot on. You know, there were moments of tension that were good. So everything has its benefits. And you can say with Time and the Rani, you know, you've got a good incidental score in Time and the Rani. You've got a certain pacing, which is fun. You've got, that's probably about it. But you get my point. There are things that you can always find good. But I still say Kill the Moon, in its objective, didn't work at all. So for me, I would say, given what it should have been able to do, it was a mess. And yes, terrible is perhaps a little bit of journalistic hyperbole to what it really was, but I think we were justified in pulling it apart, is what I'm trying to essentially say. I don't think we were being overtly critical, or we were being naysayers, or we don't enjoy Doctor Who. I think it was an episode that deserved to be dissected, because it just, perhaps the word it didn't work is perhaps what I should say, rather than terrible. Would you agree with that? It didn't really
if it
work.
Means that we can link to a sketch by Fry and Laurie from the first series.
Put it in the show notes.
Yes, I will.
So I've totally destroyed that segue I was trying to create with the gaming article.
You have. Well, to be honest with you, I'm not entirely prepared. I'm a little bit
That's
drunk.
Okay. Really? Interesting.
Yes, I've had a couple of beverages this afternoon.
Do you want to quickly explain, I know not in detail, but it's not
I've been to a funeral.
Yes, exactly. So it's not your usual behaviour.
No, it's not. I'm not like a barfly or anything like that. I've been to a funeral, so I've had a couple of beverages for a friend of mine who passed away a couple of weeks ago. So the man who would be king, that is not what we're talking about now. We're going to talk about that a bit later, I think, to some extent. But that isn't what I'm supposed to be clicking on. So I do apologise. As I say, I've had a cider and a Guinness. And
oh, my God. It suddenly sounds like I now know that you've had a couple of beverages. I now can see that you've had a couple of beverages, which I think I think that could be a sort of like a sort of odd sort of placebo fact. The fact that I now know that you have, that I now see it rather than actually that you are. I don't know. Who cares? You're clicking. I can see why you clicked the wrong one there, because it's a very similar image to the other article.
Well, they've both got Stephen Moffat in them.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
One image.
Well, no, they've got different images.
They are different images, yeah.
The one with Stephen Moffat that I should have clicked in, I'm not sure which one is Stephen Moffat. Because there's Neil Gaiman on the right, and then there's like two microphones on the left, and I'm not sure which one is the Moff. Cheeky. So, yeah, basically, there's been this little friction that we have been aware of, that we've heard from various sources, between Stephen Moffat and Neil Gaiman. And then over the last few days, Neil Gaiman has talked about the lack of female writers on Doctor Who, which is seen initially as a dig at Doctor Who in the Stephen Moffat era on the whole. Some people said, well, he said since 2008, and Russell T. Davies was in charge in 2009, so it must mean him too. I think it's probably fair to say that with four episodes in 2009...
Yeah.
That's not really the issue, is it, really? And there's been, you know, here's a... I'll give you an example here of what the general kind of gist is beyond the sexism claims, accusations, coincidence might be. Someone called Ozioma copy-pasted off a Tumblr post to provide additional context / speculation on that epic shade-throwing above. "I stole a Time Lord," said Neil Gaiman. "Actually, it was Clara who picked the TARDIS for the Doctor," says the Moff. "Fear me, I've killed all of them," says Gaiman. "Actually, the Doctor didn't. He saved them into a snow globe," says the Moff. "Writes a script about Victorian Clara versus Cybermen. Stephen Moffat kills off Victorian Clara." BBC says, "Neil, would you write a script for Doctor Who Series 8? Neil Gaiman, actually, I have a very busy schedule this year. Now, that's the facts as fans see them.
Yeah, it's not just worth pointing out that's not actually dialogue between.
No, that's not actual dialogue.
We're not saying it is. It's an amusing speculative conclusion of the events. Yeah.
Yeah, indeed. And then we've got this other element of the lack of female writers, which we've spoken about before, haven't we, on the podcast?
Yeah.
But when it's brought up by someone as high profile as Neil Gaiman, who's probably the only Doctor Who writer who has a bigger profile than Stephen Moffat and Russell T. Davies,
yeah,
then, you know, we start to wonder what's going on.
Mm. I mean, I think, as I said in the comment section just very recently, because I sort of got involved in this, to be fair, I mean, you could argue that his point about the lack of female writers isn't a commentary on any issues he may or may not or may have or may have with Stephen Moffat, but a comment on him as a writer, who is very who has a very strong feminine connections. I mean, he's connected to Amanda Palmer, who's a very, very strong feminist musician, a great musician. He could be just speaking on as a writer, sort of saying, as a writer, I'm concerned that this program should be showcasing more women writers, regardless of whoever's showrunning it. What do you think, Brian?
What do I think? You know, it's... I mean, I don't know if I have any comment on that, like anything specific like that. I just think it's quite obvious there are creative differences at play, and you have a couple. Well, I don't know too much about Neil Gaiman, but you certainly have an ego in play here, and I don't think it's too far a stretch to think that these things are true. But I don't know. I mean, you know, airing your grievances like that in public ways is something that we do all the time on these kind of podcasts, and we don't get that kind of traffic or high volume to it because we're not the main people involved. We're not the people making the show. You know, we get some gripes, we get some naysayers, and we get some flack that we have to take from time to time. But these guys, they got a much higher profile than us. And I think him saying what he said was him trying to show that he feels a change needs to be in place. And that's fine. He's a fan. He's allowed to have his opinion, but I think it gets scrutinized a heck of a lot more than if we were to do so.
So you see, think it's probably an over scrutinize of that comment that too much is being played there, suggesting the comment is about Moffat specifically, but more about an issue within the show that he is concerned about.
Yeah, I mean, there's many different ways that things can be done. You can easily just say, this is how I feel, or you could say, this is how I feel. Did you hear that, Moffat? You know, and so, I mean, there could easily be in play that he's saying that to kind of like nudge Moffat to do something else, or to get even in a sense, look at who he is and look at the people that are listening to him and the power that his word has. Now you have people out there saying, hey, that's right, Moffat, what about this? You know, so it could easily be one way or the other. All I know is it's just that when somebody, a celebrity, says something, people just take it and roll with it a lot heavier than if we, the fans, were to say it.
What about his, what's about this whole truncated conclusion that Christian's pointed out, you know, from the Tumblr post of the backwards and forth within the construction of the Doctor Who continuity that they've been involved in? Do you feel that as a writer that could genuinely be a cause of issue for, say, Neil Gaiman? Do you think that's...
Absolutely. Yeah, I absolutely do. I mean, because I think we saw that already with Moffat wanting to have a co-writing credit on half the scripts.
Mm.
You know, we saw that play out. But also, if I'm not mistaken, we've also heard Neil Gaiman say in certain articles when Stephen Moffat was the one who said that he's already told the world that the Doctor could be a woman. Neil Gaiman came out and said, actually, that was my line in the script. You know, so it's like you don't take credit for somebody else's work, essentially. And that's always going to go down poorly with the person who originally did it. So, yeah, I do think there's a bit of that.
I mean,
that depends on whether you saw the post on Facebook from the editor of a popular magazine one night. But yeah, moving on. So Neil Gaiman has expanded on what he said. There's a blog post.
Right.
And he paraphrased Tastic Time. As I've lost the link and I can't really read the entire post out to anyone. He basically summarizes exactly what he meant was my reply about, quote, nobody to hug was mostly wistful, by the way, and not, as I've seen it interpreted, an attack on the Doctor Who team or anyone on the team. In the 6 years I've been working with the Doctor Who team, 6 years, that's a long time, isn't it? It's 2008. I've been working with the Doctor Who team. The producers and script editors I've directly worked with, 4 out of 6 of whom have been women, have had a lot of attention on getting women writers onto the team. They've reached out to a lot of women writers. I know that Stephen Moffat has personally been trying to touch with a lot of, has been in touch, I hope that wasn't a Freudian slip, with a lot of female writers, and been defeated over and over by schedule problems and people say no, and being as frustrated as anybody, probably much more frustrated as he's the one reaching out. It's a priority for them too.
So one could either argue a backtrack or a clarification, because I mean, yeah, he could have genuinely sort of been saying that, not that the show should have by now had women writers on, it could have just been saying as a general point, the show should have had more female writers since 2008, but hasn't, regardless of the reason.
Isn't it just kind of, you know, Doctor Who's been back for nearly 10 years and it's had one female writer. And in the, how many female writers did it have in the 1980s? Two or three?
Well, this is it.
I mean, that's the 80s.
I mean, this is what I was trying to fight in the commentary, because there's a lot of people who will say, and there is an argument for this, is that you can't quota writers based on gender.
No, absolutely
based
not.
On skill.
You shouldn't.
But at the same time, there is an inherent difficulty for women, creative writers for women, and in certain creative roles, for women to get into the industry. It still is a problem.
I think genre
does help.
If you look at Emmerdale, if you look at Coronation Street, you look at EastEnders, you look at the day-to-day real life and the historical dramas, there are at least 50% written by women. As soon as you come into the area of Doctor Who, Life on Mars, Ashes to Ashes, Primeval, The Fades, the Channel 4, Utopia, anything like that, and suddenly it's the majority, being human, the majority of the scriptwriters are male.
Well, again, I think this is a debatable point. I'm not quite sure whether your percentages are entirely accurate. I'm just having a look just down through Google, and you know, initial commentary sort of has women writers at around 35%. Again, I've not looked in to see where the sources are for that. So, but I would still say that it is still a very male dominated industry. That, and I don't think there's many in the industry, or well, industry itself is still male dominated. That's, you know, full stop.
I think you get a lot of, I mean, maybe it's because they're women. I don't know, but you know, you've got people like Linda LaPlante. You've got the lady from Leeds, whose name escapes me at the moment, Kay Mellor. You've got other well-known women writers of TV drama, and whereas with fellas, you only get whoever's in charge of Doctor Who is like the well-known TV writer. These days, you know, post, you know, Dennis Potter.
Well, this is it. I mean, I'm just looking at another article. Again, we're just rushing through them. So I'm just taking these figures mm-hmm. out. But yes. Again, suggesting here, early reports commissioned by the UK Film Council, and this is in the last 10 years, highlighted lack of women writing British film and television. The figures here sort of put in the UK industry, women represented 19% of writers and 15% of directors for British films. Yeah. Now that's films, but I think the point is that, you know, if there is, and let's just go on the assumption that there is an imbalance between women and male writers for whatever reason, whether it's a male dominated industry, whether it's lifestyles, whatever reason, I think you could argue that as a show like Doctor Who, and especially as you say, Christian, with science fiction again being not a very good niche or not an obvious niche for female writers, is there an argument that they should be looking to showcase new women writers in the same way that Doctors does, or as I said, 2000 AD has done successfully for 20 yeah. 30 years, showcased young new talent that hasn't had much exposure or any exposure, who then often fly off to America and become extremely famous. Mark Miller, Grant Morrison, Alan Grant, Pat Mills, whatever you want to go for. Well, not Pat Mills, because he was one of the instigators behind it, but that's my point. So is there an argument that Doctor Who should, and it sounds like they are trying, but maybe that is why Gaiman is concerned, that you have such a high profile sci-fi show which has the ability to pool or find new women writers. Is the industry failing in that sense?
Well, you know, there's the other side of it as well. I'm a subscriber to Writing Magazine. Is it Writing Magazine or Writers Magazine? One of those two. Well, I've got one in front of me, so let's just double check. Writing Magazine. And now the vast majority of interviews in there seem to be with women writers, novelists. In terms of personnel in charge or working on it, you know, the most recent issue has contributions from David Quantick, from Professor David Nash, from Tim Ellison, from Sally Jenkins. So that's contributed. People have been writing articles or interviewing people. But the interview subjects often seem to be women. And at first that struck me as strange. Well, then I had to think about it. And women's authors, you know, women tend to read more books than men, don't they? Of the fictional variety. We've got a lot of historical books that are quite popular, you know, like costume drama in book form. They often, not always, but they're often written by women. And that made me wonder whether or not there is something about the mediums that are drawing men and women to them. Maybe there's something about film and television and the act of drafting a screenplay, which is a little more urgent than drafting a novel. When I say urgent, I mean it's a more of a compact experience because you're leaving description and all that kind of thing to the director on the whole, whereas with the novel, it's more of a organic growing experience. I might be saying something that's utterly profound here and not realising it, but I do wonder if that is what maybe female writers, women, are more drawn to the novel and the short story than they are to writing for TV just because of the differences between the mediums.
Or maybe you could, again, the other counter argument could be that writing a novel is a more singular control system than getting into the industry, which is a far more of a co-joined mechanism of people. And so maybe it is harder for women to get into that, or maybe it's harder to find the comfort. Maybe I don't know. I mean, I still get the feeling that as a woman, it's probably a lot harder, a creative woman, to slip into these industries as it is a man. And if you think of the industry as how wide and big it is, you know, do we spot women's names because they're unusual? I mean, everything I seem to read seems to suggest they don't have. It's not a balanced situation yet. And the question is, why is that? Is that the fault of the industry? Is that the fault of society? Is that because women in society operate differently? I don't know. But I certainly think that Doctor Who should have more women writers on it. Because, I mean, if you look at Blake Seven, someone put this out in the commentary, and I think this is in the comments, and I think this is very true. If you look at Blake Seven, it had a couple of... I remember one women writer on it was Tanith Lee, and she did a couple of episodes in series 3 and 4. And they were very, very different to the other stories, the approach. Now, again, that could be that she's a different sort of writer. It could be that some people have said it's because she has that female and men do have different perspectives. I really don't know. I mean, this is, you know, books are written on this. In fact, I'm looking at a Google page of a book written on women writing for television. You know, it's a massive academic subject, so it's very hard for us to debate it out in like 10, 15 minutes. But yeah, I do feel that it would be interesting to see Kate Orman for the New Adventures. She did very different approaches to writing those than, say, Paul Cornell. Again, yeah. whether is that because she's a woman, or is that just simply she's a very different writer? I don't know. But while there's an imbalance in the genders, visible imbalance in the genders, in especially in science fiction, I think, you know, I just hope that Doctor Who is as Gaiman and as another lady in the comments section who worked with Doctor Who suggest, that they are genuinely looking for female writers, but for whatever reasons, it's just not happening. Mm. But yes, I don't believe that they should be just got simply because you need a woman writer this series. It should be that, you know, women are not, you know, that it's harder. I mean, this is what I say, you know, you have training programs and people think that's fine. It's okay to sort of have startup programs to get people into industries. That's cool. But as soon as, you know, there may be whether it's a gender, it's not. So, you know, if you sort of said, well, we're trying to get help women into the industry, that'd be considered patronizing or say, you know, that you know, they can get on. Why should they get preference? Yet at the same time, if they're not able to get into the industry for whatever reason, perhaps they do need a helping hand to create the balance to a point where we don't need to worry about gender and it is equal terms. I don't know. As you see, this is something that fascinates me, so I could go on for ages. I don't know what the answer is. It's
well, basically, I mean, I think we've already hit on the answer, and the answer is pretty much, to me anyway, is writers should be picked based on talent or if they fit the role, not on a quota.
Yes, definitely.
You know, and yeah, I mean, yeah, and I think, you know, we've seen that, you know, they had some male writers in the past that even in the new series that just didn't really quite do the job quite as well, and it's just, you know, it's always going to be a hit and miss thing, but you don't just want to go ahead. And for instance, we brought up X-Files before, I think, when we were talking about writers. Mm-hmm. Stephen King is a very well-respected novelist. He wrote that episode of the X-Files that just really failed to capture me and failed to capture many people, as a matter of fact. And he even completely missed the mark on who Mulder and Scully were. So, at least Mulder anyway. So Chris Carter had to actually rewrite all of the Mulder scenes just to make it work. You know, some people just aren't suited for the type of material that's working because they either don't get it or it's not their thing. So you got to pick a writer that's definitely going to do the right job rather than just pick a writer and say, hey, we've got six male writers now. So now we need to complete this out. We need at least three female writers here. It just doesn't work. It's not a wise idea unless those writers, like, in all honesty, I was very curious, you know, having seen all of the films, and I haven't read the books, but I was very curious to see what J.K. Rowling would have done, only because she's somebody in my mind who gets the fantastical and gets the fantasy kind of side of things. And while it could have been a complete flop, who knows, it might have been very interesting too. So I think she's somebody that, in my eyes anyway, is clearly suited to this type of world, this type of fantasy realm, and maybe the science fiction angle. But aside from that, you know, I don't know myself too many other female writers, because like you said, most of the shows we watch are dominated by male writers.
And it's not just, I mean, the issue might be it's not just dominated by male writers, but it's dominated by you know, male productions, and yes, there are female in productions as well, and there are female directors, you know, it's, yeah, not suggesting there aren't, but I think from what I've read, and you know, you've got statistics saying that certainly in the UK women are still paid less than men for same roles generally. Mm-hmm. That still happens. So while you've got all these imbalances, you've got all these you know, inadvertent prejudices, you know, to me it makes sense that you should be looking, not to be looking for a quota, but you should be looking at ways to try and encourage or showcase different types of writers. And invariably, maybe I've got, you know, if you're a woman to a man, you've got different perspectives on life. That's a fact. You've got to, because you come from two different social upbringings, don't you? You know, women are brought up to be in a different way to the way men are. In that, you can't argue that men are blue, women are pink, which, you know, once upon a time was the other way around. So they're going to have, surely in the writing, there is going to be differences between male and female. There's going to be a different color, surely, because perspectives are different. Surely, in a sense, therefore, you know, maybe looking at women writers for science fiction could offer something. I don't know. It's a fascinating thing. It's just so.
Here's a question for you, though. Kill the Moon, the end scene with Clara being upset with the Doctor. Would that episode have been better written by a woman?
I think so, definitely. As I've said throughout our podcast, I still think there is a lot of male writing of women in television where it doesn't work for me, because only women are allowed to be irrational. Only Amy Pond would be allowed to get the Doctor's tie stuck in a doorway, you know, like 10 minutes before the world's going to explode, because she wants to know right now what's going on. You never get a man doing that in a TV show. And so you feel that there are certain male prejudices there, that the women are irrational, almost going back to the whole 1940s, where, you know, if women weren't sedated regularly, they got hysterical. And if you didn't sedate them enough, they ended up being a femme fatale, pretty much. You know, there is that still sort of male factor to women, that there is that sort of tantrumy, irrational anger and outbursts which make female drama. They're strong women, but they still have these sort of irrational moments, and these that they still act in male models of what females do, which I don't think you get so much when women write it. So yeah, I think so. I think a woman would write a lot of these scenes differently. And probably to shock a lot of men, probably not the way that men would like to imagine. But there you go. I don't know. And maybe vice versa as well. It'd be interesting to see how women write men and how accurately they get. I don't know.
I also think it's, and I maybe this doesn't need to be said, but I also think it's important to remind everyone that without Jane Trader, we would not have the new series of Doctor Who right now. You know, and without Julie Gardner, half of the things that Russell T. Davis did might have been very different.
But then,
you know, so while they may not be writing, they still have a position of power to say yes or no that makes things better or worse. Who knows? But I think Julie Gardner certainly did a lot of good for the series.
Well, absolutely. Well, OK, you go back to Verity Lambert. But then if you go back to Verity Lambert, yeah. You can go to Adventures of Time and Space, which highlights that in the 60s how hard it was for a female woman to get to a role of producer. I mean, OK, we've now gone 50 years past. But exactly. I still think those hierarchies are going to still be there, especially in institutions like the BBC. I don't think things change that quickly.
I agree. I think they're still there. But I think it's very telling that there were two very strong female roles within the new series of Doctor Who from the start.
Absolutely.
You know, but I agree. I'm sure that stuff is still there. But I think it's very telling. And I think both of them did some wonderful things for the show. And I think going back a little too far to Verity Lambert, I think that's a little too far, a little too distant right now to kind of relate to the writers of today.
But then at the same time, as I say, today in the UK, women are still paid less.
Yeah.
Now, you can't ignore the fact that there is still a hierarchy issue there where there isn't gender balance. You're getting some very smart and very strong and very determined women who will break through those. And you will get... You will get men who are in the industry who do not have a gender issue, who will not encourage out of patronizing, but will hire or will encourage people who are great, whether they're men and women. So again, it's very difficult not to make this too black and white. But I think while studies are still saying there is an imbalance there, I think what my main summary would be that productions which have the power to be slightly indulgent, like Doctor Who, should be looking towards occasionally addressing that issue and maybe make a conscious effort to see what pools of women writers are out there, and not as a quota, but just being aware of it. And maybe by the sounds of what Gaiman says, if what he says is true, maybe they are. So
okay, well, let's move on and let's have a little bit of a chat about the other thing which I accidentally clicked on earlier, which is our new series of articles on the website, which we have titled somewhat ironically, which I noticed someone picked up in the comment section, The Man Who Would Be King, and in which we are going to be looking at the various candidates as we see it, on a very secretive list that we have that you don't have and you won't have until it's finished, dear listener, to take over from Stephen Moffat, who has admitted that he's closer to the end of his tenure than the beginning. We're not saying he's on the way out tomorrow. We're not asking him to leave. We're just suggesting these are people who we feel are the most likely candidates to take over from the man we once called the Grand Moff. So we kicked off with an intro and then with Mark Gatiss. And so that's something that's going on the website at the moment. And it's going to be a weekly thing. We've got another candidate next week. You'll probably find that it starts off with people that you've thought of. And as the weeks progress, they will be people that you haven't thought of in a million years, basically. That's as many spoilers as I'm giving you on this. Lest Riversong come and assault me with her sonic screwdriver.
Blimey.
Yeah, I've never been a big drinker, to be honest with you. So have you guys checked those articles out yet?
No, sorry.
No, it's okay. You can say yes, you know, you can lie.
Yes.
Yes. I meant yes.
Yes, I thought you did.
I was confused. I thought you meant a different article.
No, you thought I was talking
well,
about...
Well, we're part of the writers team, so we did sort of know what names were coming out, which is why I've not leaped at the articles. I knew.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Indeed. Okay. I think, have we covered everything that we discussed that we were going to be covering?
I think we may have done that.
We can go into recommendation onlys then, can't we?
Oh, must we?
That part, yeah.
That part, yeah. Well, we can't do that thing that Brian and I wanted to do because James doesn't watch the trailers. Apart from that time when he did.
I think I did watch the trailer for next week. Yes, I did.
Right?
Yeah, I did. I did watch it.
Well, tough. We're still doing recommendations.
Oh.
Good. You know what? I've forgotten the trailer.
That's good, amazing. So have I. But I have a recommendation which landed on my doorstep on Saturday morning. And on Saturday mornings here at Casterbridge Towers, it's Saturday. So, you know, it's a kind of day where not much work gets done because I tend to, I take the twins dancing basically because they're three now and they've been dancing since they're 18 months old and they do weekly dance classes.
God, no wonder you drink.
Yes, so I had no idea that this had arrived until it didn't arrive, basically, because a card popped through the door, which I found when I returned home at lunchtime, to say that someone had tried to deliver a parcel, but because the postage hadn't been paid on it, BBC Books, I would have to go to the local depot and pay for it. So I'm delighted to know that the franking machine is working at Penguin. Thanks, Penguin, who owned the BBC Books name. And they sent me I'll quit the complaining now because this is a great read. This is one of your Doctor Who Christmas list books, basically. It came out last week, Secret Lives of Monsters.
Okay.
It follows the pattern. It's guess who it's by without googling.
Neil Gaiman.
No, Justin Richards.
Stephen Moffat. Okay.
No, Justin Richards. Like virtually
everyone. Wait, is it Justin Richards?
It is, yeah. How did you know? Oh, it's really good. I'm impressed, Brian.
Russell T. Davis.
And it's one. it's one of these books that I put together Batman. Like a scrapbook. But it covers Classic Who. It covers the. I'm looking at the Silence now. Oh, there's the Ood. Here's the Autons. Oh, there's Plastic Mickey's head.
Yeah. But what's the drive here? What's the hook?
The hook is, ignorance is not bliss. It is the alien invader's greatest advantage. It's essentially, know your monsters.
Right.
So it takes a different spin on what we've had before. Says the press release, tales of unearthly beings have long circulated among us, from legends of intelligent life on Earth before Homo sapiens to conspiracy theories about what really happened at the Battle of Canary Wharf. But the truth is that alien life exists, and here, at last, is proof. So if you think of one of those kind of 1990s UFO books,
yeah,
it's along that kind of vibe, really. It's a good book. It's well presented. You know, it is a theme that tends to be mined on an annual basis,
yes,
by BBC Books in its various incarnations. And one does wonder if they're ever going to stop or run out of ideas. But certainly, if the evidence on this £20 hardback tome is anything to go by, they haven't run out of ideas yet. If you're a fan of Doctor Who monsters, and you're watching Doctor Who, so you probably are, that should be on your Christmas list, dear listener. Brian, recommendation from you?
You know, I haven't really been watching too much lately, so I'm going to go ahead and continue my Bond theme and tell everybody. The next one I watched was The World Is Not Enough. So, yeah,
I
recommend that.
Good, like that
I caught Moonraker the other night.
Yeah, it's a good one. What's that?
Yeah, I haven't watched Moonraker.
Oh, nice, yeah.
Which I haven't seen all the way through. I didn't see it all the way through because I fell asleep. I didn't even know it was on until I caught Gareth Cavanagh tweets on a Friday and Saturday night about what he's watching on either ITV4 or BBC4, as you guys may have seen. And on Friday or Saturday, it was Moonraker. So I thought, oh, I haven't seen Moonraker in years. Maybe I'll put it on. But unfortunately, it had been on for like 90 minutes. So I put on ITV4+1, which I didn't know existed until Saturday night when I just happened to check. Like every channel's got a plus one these days. Sorry?
No, go on.
Brian?
Go on.
Yeah, okay. And yeah. I fell asleep. Scene after the cable, straight after the cable car scene, I fell asleep.
So near, not very long into it, really.
No, about 40 minutes in, yeah. So that was disappointing. Yeah. It was late at night. And I had been at the Black Beer.
Black Beer, again, another.
Well, it's a stout. And what it comes in a beer, in a sort of a wine bottle sort of thing. And you put in, say, half to a full inch of this stuff in the bottom of a glass of lemonade. And then you top it up with lemonade. And it's a very, very nice drink. I've only just discovered it. We've had it in the cupboard for about 2 years. And it's dilute alcohol. It's brilliant. Dilute beer. Make your own beer from this dilute. It's like having orange squash. I'm not a regular drinker. I just had it because it was Saturday, basically. It's a lovely drink. Lovely drink. I like stuff. I do like one of the things about stopping drinking, which I did for a long time, was stout, because stout is a very enjoyable drink. There you go.
I like how your recommendation is a film that you actually fell asleep halfway through.
Well, it's because it is a good film, and you know, it's got lots of good things about it, Moonraker. But the thing I don't like about it is that it's essentially it's The Spy Who Loved Me in negative,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Because instead of the guy being under killing all life on Earth and taking everyone under the sea, he takes them all out into space.
Yeah.
And there's that rather pat ending with Jaws and the little blonde lady. But all of the things that lead up to the Star Wars bit is really good, I think.
Yeah, it's a laugh, isn't it?
It basically goes from being quite a convincing spy movie into a Star Wars pastiche for the last 30 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's a sort of film I like because I remember it as a kid watching on television at Christmases, not because I actually think it's a particular great bit of James Bond as a franchise. But Brian, did you have anything to say on World Is Not Enough? You did sit through and watch it all.
Oh yeah, no, it's one of my all time favorite things about that film. Is the exit scene that they gave for Desmond Llewellyn.
Yes.
Mainly because, according to him, before he had passed away, was...
rather than after.
Killed. Yeah.
I see, right.
Yeah, he said he had planned, you know, he had plans to do the next film, so he would have been in the 40th anniversary film. Which, you know, makes sense considering it was the anniversary film and they were just setting up the fact, hey, I'm retiring. But the fact that he had that untimely death and they had shot this beautiful scene where, you know, Bond tells him or asks him rather, you know, you're not retiring anytime soon, are you? And then he just looks at him. He's like, what have I always tried to teach you? These two things. And, you know, one, watch your back, and two, always have an exit plan. And then he just starts lowering through the floor and they just stare at each other. And it's like, it's amazing. It's just knowing that there would have been another scene after that. It is kind of sad because it would have been great to see him again, but knowing that fact and knowing of his untimely death, it's amazing that they were able to get that scene for his last scene. So, you know, there's so many brilliant things in this movie. It was a very good script. It was a very good story. I loved all the characters. Certainly Renard. He was a very interesting kind of concept for the bad guy and the situation there.
Quite low key as well. It wasn't played up particularly. And Coltrane's great in it as well.
He's probably in terms of villains go, he's probably the most fully painted villain since Christopher Walken's. In terms of, you know who the guy is.
Yes,
you know all these things about him.
Yeah.
I'm not saying the Walken's villain is particularly good because, you know, some days of Utrecht is brilliant, other days of Utrecht is absolutely terrible.
Mm.
But, you know, the quality of the characterization is really strong with him.
Well, and it's great, too, because, you know, they tried to do that thing which I love, which is the fantastical element to him. You know, the guy has a bullet in his brain, but he's still alive. You know, the guy, you know, he gets that amazing line. When Bond says, you know, that he's going to kill him and, you know, he's there to assassinate him. And he says, you know, a man tires of being assassinated. And it's just like only somebody who has a bullet in their brain from an assassination attempt and who is still alive can be able to say a line like that.
It's
brilliant. It's amazing. But what's great about it is it works. Somehow it just works. It doesn't seem like it's too far on the fantastical, while obviously it's like also at the same time completely unbelievable. But it works here so well in the story. And it gives him that element, which I love in Bond films, which they do so well. And it just really sells the character to me, aside from the fact that, of course, you know, you've got the reverse of the Stockholm syndrome working there.
Mm. Yeah, yeah, that's a clever twist. James, yeah. Recommendation?
I must admit, I've not really been able to watch much this week, so I'm sort of a little staggered to find something that's both topical or relevant. I mean, I did watch Double Indemnities this week.
Oh, the original?
The original, yes.
Is this for coursework?
It was, actually. It was on a screening. But the reason I brought it up was just because it does link into the angle of women in cinema and television. And it's worth... I mean, obviously, it's a very famous
film. Actually, when you said femme fatale earlier, the first thing that came to my head was Barbara Stanwyck. It always is.
Yeah.
Whenever I see it or hear it, yeah.
And it's a funny film because it's one of those sort of films which has got such a classic edge to it. It's very much of the film noir era. And yet at the same time, when you watch it, it has such a lack of believability in character motivations.
But that's kind of...
Which goes with the... To a certain degree, goes with the genre, yeah.
Yeah,
but... And the use of women, again, is quite fascinating. In some ways, it hasn't changed massively, but we still seem to recoil at horror at the shock idea of the femme fatale.
Yeah. The funny thing about the film, I always think, is you have all these, you know, the way it starts with the recording device and the night time and everything, and then like the death of her husband, and then it's all strangely counterpointed by meeting in the supermarket.
Yes.
It's the most un-noir thing ever, isn't it? Meeting in a supermarket.
I mean, I just love the way the genre can get away with things you just couldn't do anywhere else, even then and now. Like, for instance, you know, he meets her once and obviously is attracted to her, meets her a second time. She sort of slightly suggests that she might want to kill her husband, and he says, no, I'm not interested. He goes off, and then you have this silly montage of him. He's obviously frustrated, so he goes to see a picture, or he goes to a bowling alley, and then he comes back home and says, but yes, I knew deep down that I was going to commit murder for her. And you think, what? Really? Why? Why? And you know, those terrible cheesy sort of film noir lines in it, you know, who knew that a murder would smell like honeysuckle or whatever it is. And I think sometimes it's just nice to go back and look at different periods and different eras and just seeing what...
Well, it's eye-opening stuff, isn't it? And especially when you consider, you know, a lot of people think of the old movies as being in much as people think of former cultures as being in some way... you know, basic. And they're not at all.
Books, yes.
Yeah, and they're not at all.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you've only got to watch some incredible stuff, especially at the time when you even got less, you know, less technology at your fingertips. And you take, say, Touch of Evil, and you take that opening...
You're basically doing my A-level film studies in your first semester, by the sound of things.
Well, you know, I've always quite enjoyed sort of 1940s movies anyway, so I've sort of, it wasn't too much of a hassle to sort of sit down and watch some of the stuff here. But it is fascinating when you look at it even more seriously and see the differences in approach. And I think what you just said just encapsulates it, that we do tend to look back at previous times where obviously technologies and techniques and the ability to form productions was a lot less cogent than it is now, and then consider that things will be more basic, simpler, not as clever, and it's totally not true.
Someone only has to look at 5 minutes of Metropolis to see that, surely.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the opening Metropolis, you watch that and you think, my God, how the hell do that with what you got? And it's, you know, it's pretty seamless and flawless. So, yes, no, I mean, my point being is if you want my recommendation is that if you're in the UK, what I always tend to do is I always go and sort of drop onto iPlayer and just see what films are running on iPlayer, and you'll be surprised at what sort of odds and ends you'll get, which might seem insignificant until you actually watch it. I mean, a couple of months ago, I watched Tender Comrade, is it? Which is a Ginger Rogers film, which is in itself, I just saw it on there, clicked it and watched it. And yet when you go into the film history and you find out how it was very much hit by the fear of communism in the 40s and in America, and the use of comrade in the title, and you have Ginger Rogers' mother up on the stand denouncing the film as socialist, when in fact, if you watch it, it's horrendously nationalistic for the war effort. It's incredible what you can just find by just going on to sort of iPlayer and just seeing what films are out there and just pick them. Don't worry about them in black and white or color. Just pick something random and you'll be amazed sometimes at what it will tell you. So, yeah. Yes,
indeed. And in fact, probably just one more recommendation as well. With Nell and I is currently in cinemas.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Been remastered. So if you're near a cinema.
Two more recommendations I've got. I should remember this. One, obviously, the amazing news at Twin Peaks is think is just absolutely stunning.
Okay,
can't believe that. And secondly, I should have mentioned this. I was talking to Brian about this before we started. I've been working on this Millennium campaign for about 6-7 years now to sort of bring back this rather classic late 1990s serial killer stroke evil mythology series from the States, done by the same guy as The X-Files, Chris Carter. Bring it back. It only had 3-season run. IDW Publishing announced on Friday, I think it was, that they were going to be running a short miniseries of five comic-ish miniseries on Millennium. May follow through to a full comic season if it does well, starting, I think, January 2015. So for me, that's obviously been a quite an exciting thing, because I've been doing this campaign called Back to Frank Black, about bringing Frank Black back, for the last 6-7 years. And, you know, in some form, in a media form of comic, the character is coming back. So it's been a nice my recommendation there is, if you've not seen Millennium, read up on it. DVDs are normally quite well priced. Great cinematography, great series, great acting, a bench runner for a lot of stuff since then. And if you've got money to spend and you're looking at comics in 2015, try it, because I'm sure it'd be great. It's written by Joe Harris, who's a very smart man. And while it's not really linked to Doctor Who in any way, I think if you are interested in television and film, which I think you must be to be listening to this podcast, because we are quite critical, it's worth a look.
Excellent. Okay, then. That brings us to the end of this week's Casterbridge podcast with a K. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for bearing with my lateness, and we'll see you next time. Goodbye.